Okay, well, good afternoon, everybody. I'm very excited for this week's episode as we have a member in the Industrial Insiders community who's joining us, and she is an expert in insurance, which is a topic that might not be the most exciting to think about at the beginning, but she finds a way to make it very exciting, which is why I'm such a big fan of hers. Skylar, thanks so much for joining me on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me here. I'm glad that you think it's exciting. I know a lot of people are not very happy with the renewals that they've had and some of the challenges that they've had in the insurance space over the last few years, especially, but we try to keep it light. Well, I don't know if we'd say light, but try to keep it as much control in the buyer's hands as possible. And I think people appreciate that. And making the information less opaque is something that's really important to me. And so I think having these types of conversations makes the whole insurance monster a little bit less intimidating and more palatable for everybody. So hopefully we can do that here today.
Oh, I'm sure we will. And your Twitter profile, you've only been on it for 6 months or so. Is that about right?
It's been 6 months. Yeah.
6 months.
Yeah. I think we're right about there.
And in that time, you've developed a great profile, great following. You've put out some great information. What I think separates you from other insurance people that I've spoken with is that you really do take back the curtain on what can be an overwhelming or complicated process. And I think that this is such an important topic as well, that a lot of people just almost put insurance to the back burner and that it's not something that they think about all the time. When in reality, this is such an important conversation because, first of all, you can't own or buy industrial real estate without having an insurance policy. And if you get an insurance policy that you don't even understand, you might get the wrong policy that perhaps doesn't give you coverage. If there's an issue, something might arise where you don't have the coverage that you expected. So there's a lot at play here. And I think a lot of people underestimate what's involved. And you and I talked the other day, even just with the tenants in a building, that can have a pretty big implication on insurance itself. And I know myself, even properties that I owned, I hadn't thought about that, about putting in a new tenant that might be unorthodox or a non-traditional industrial user, what actually happens to the coverage or what happens to the underwriting process. So those are kind of the topics that I want to jump into as well. And then we'll also have time if people have questions in a little bit here, we can certainly get to any questions as well. But perhaps we could even just start off with a summary of what the insurance landscape looks like right now, because I'm sure this is a conversation you're having with people daily. There's a lot of challenges. It seems like certain markets don't even want to have coverage, or it's very expensive to get. What would be your summary on the 30,000 foot view on the state of the insurance market right now?
Sure. So loaded question, right? Because there's
yes,
so
right off the bat.
So many things that go into it. It's been a tough market for the last few years. I think everybody's kind of well aware of that at this point. If you're in the market as a buyer and you've been purchasing insurance, you're aware that since about 2020, 2021, the market's been constricting and it's been a tougher market cycle than it was prior to that. So we're all kind of aware of that, especially if you're in the real estate space, if you're buying property insurance in the United States, that's kind of where we've been. So reinsurance markets have been constricting. And I don't know how familiar everyone is with the concept of reinsurance or how deep we want to get into that. Maybe that's a later question we want to touch on. But as reinsurance markets constrict globally, we're feeling that on our end too. So a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel, and we can go more into this later if we want to too. And I don't want to get too positive because I think we're still going to continue to feel some pain for the next few years. But one positive sign that we've seen that's a positive leading indicator is our 1/1/2024 reinsurance renewals in the United States were overall less painful than the 1/1/2023 reinsurance renewals were. And what that is kind of the book overall of renewals for the insurance carriers for property in the United States on a global reinsurance scale. So what that means is that aside from major loss issues on an individual account basis or, you know, catastrophe exposure, things like wildfire in California, you know, wind, hailstorm in Florida and Colorado, things like that, overall property rates are going up at a less fast pace. I won't say that they're going down yet, right? But they're increasing at a slower pace than they were increasing previously. So that's a positive sign on the horizon. But as we all know, things have been tough for a while. So that's kind of the 50,000 foot view. As we know, and we were just kind of talking about before we started recording, certain carriers have pulled out of the space completely, just aren't willing to write insurance anymore. So that's part of the equation. And as that happens, it's kind of a function of the market, right? It's a free market and it's not. There's a lot of regulation, but when certain carriers decide, hey, I'm just not going to write this class anymore, this class of business. So they could either decide, everybody has different underwriting guidelines. So they can decide, I'm not going to write real estate at all anymore as a class of business, or they might decide, I'm not going to write multifamily real estate, or I'm not going to write industrial real estate. Or to your point, I'll write industrial real estate, but I'm not going to write industrial real estate that has high hazard tenants. So maybe I'll write an industrial real estate that has, you know, XYZ, but I'm not going to write it if they have an auto body shop. You know, or I'll write it if they have an auto body shop, but I'm not going to write it if they have an auto body shop that doesn't have a certain type of ventilation procedure. And if they say they have this ventilation procedure, I'm going to send someone out to go inspect that risk. And if I send someone out to go inspect that risk and they don't have the ventilation in place that they said they did, they're either going to have 90 days to put that in, which could be a significant expense, right? Or I'm going to cancel the policy. So that's another change that we've seen in our space that's been significant over the past couple of years, is just the level of underwriting scrutiny. And I've been doing this for 17 years now, you know, in different roles, but I've been in the industry for 17 years. The level of underwriting scrutiny and the access to data that underwriters have. And this was a conversation that I've had regularly, you know, recently, but I was having it with a couple of people again yesterday. It's kind of like when you were a kid, and you know, when you would get in trouble, and you, not that any of us ever got in trouble, but if your friend or maybe your brother, someone else got in trouble, and you know, you'd be like, God, how did my mom figure that out? And your mom would say, oh, I have eyes in the back of my head. Did you ever hear that phrase? That's what it's like working with underwriters now, where they will find something out about a risk. And it's like, how did they even know that? Because they have access to so much different data. And they have their own proprietary systems, and they have real-time satellite imaging, and they're pulling all of these different maps. So that's one thing now that's different too, right? Is, let's say you send a property in to me as the broker. So I have a location, and we have our tools too that we're pulling, and you're giving me a certain amount of information. But what's really had to change is, as you alluded to, a lot of people are unhappy with insurance. And I get that, right? Insurance sucks. Nobody loves it, but it's something that you have to have, right? As you mentioned, you cannot buy a building without it. Unless you don't have a lender and you're willing to go bare and not have insurance, you cannot buy a building without insurance. You're going to have to deal with it. So make your broker your best friend. And I'm not just saying that because I'm your broker. I'm saying that because you're going to have to deal with an insurance company on the other end of the transaction. And if you are not upfront with your broker, the insurance carrier is going to figure out what's going on. Maybe not right away, but they're going to figure everything out eventually. I've run into things even like they'll pull a real-time satellite image and figure out that there's a homeless encampment a block away. Things like that. Whereas if I knew that ahead of time, if someone had told me, we can work around that and come up with a story, right? Or we can come up with a mitigation plan. We can find a way to make sure that that's going to get cleaned up in the next 60 days or 90 days, right? And so then we've gone in and played offense, because you always want to be playing offense if there's an issue. You don't want to get to the point where the carrier's brought it up first, and now you're playing defense, trying to explain something away. Then you're already working behind the eight ball, right? So there are a lot of, I think, bad buying habits that were created by the soft market, because years ago, you could just kind of send in a halfway submission with a location address and maybe a little bit of information, and five carriers would quote it, and it would be pretty cheap, and you had options, and, you know, didn't take a whole lot to be an insurance broker. Frankly, you could get quotes and send them out and quote on price, and our job was relatively easy. And I think it created a lot of bad buying habits. I think it created a lot of bad broker habits. And now that we're in a harder market and underwriters just aren't working that way anymore, we're really dealing with the effects of that. And so people are frustrated. I mean, we're dealing with it too. We're kind of in the middle, right? Carriers are frustrated with the buyer. Buyers are frustrated with the carrier. And we're trying to play intermediary and make sure that everybody gets coverage and the carriers are still willing to write coverage. And so that's kind of where we're at.
Well, the interesting part about it and where you add value to the situation is that it's gone from being a commodity. Insurance is no longer just get the lowest price that you can, find the person that'll do it the cheapest, because there's so much nuance and there's so much risk, as you stated, that if you don't have a relationship with an insurance broker, you're putting yourself in a position where you'll be defensive. You'll be responding to things much more reactionary as opposed to being proactive with it. So I couldn't agree more with your statement about having somebody on your side. It's no different than having an attorney, having a real estate broker, having an engineer, whatever it is. I think insurance broker should be a pivotal part of the team. Let's jump into some of those risks that are actually out there. And you and I talked about this the other day, is that it could be as simple as an industrial building where there was an industrial tenant in there. Maybe there's a 3PL or a manufacturing or a warehousing tenant, but a traditional industrial user. And what's become pretty common now in a lot of buildings is these indoor participation groups. So it could be a foam fighters or laser tag or a trampoline park. But now it's gone from that industrial use to a use where there's a lot of kids, there's a risk of injury. That actually happened in an industrial building in my market. A kid was a one of those trampoline parks where there's a big foam pit, and he did a backflip off the diving board or whatever it was, and he went right through the foam, hit his head, and was paralyzed from it in an industrial building, which you just wouldn't even think of that being a risk. But naturally, everybody got sued on that. The tenant got sued, the landlord got sued, like everybody got sued because the kid was left paralyzed. So but most people don't think that. They just think, okay, yeah, let's put in a jump park or a trampoline park without even really giving it any second thought, and perhaps not even updating the insurance on that. So with that example specifically, let's jump in on that because I think that that's worth exploring. If you have an industrial building, how important are the tenants? And then what happens when you change tenants?
Yeah. Well, don't let your underwriters hear that, first of all. I mean, it's critical, right? So your underwriters are probably asking for rent rolls already. If they're not, they will be. It's something that's been common on real estate accounts forever. One thing that's kind of incredible to me is because it's the way that we deal with our clients, they've kind of always known what's going on their insurance. We're just communicative by nature, me and my team. I'm realizing that a lot of people, their insurance buying process is very opaque. So maybe they don't understand what's been going on behind the scenes or why things are the way they are, which is interesting to me. But this is part of the reason that underwriters want to see your rent rolls, right? So I don't know if it's normal. You own some industrial properties, right? Have you been, do your underwriters typically ask for your rent rolls at renewal? Do you know? Is that part of your
They
process?
have,
Right. Okay.
but what's interesting though is that they don't ask for updates, right? And real estate never stays consistent. There's always turnover. So you provide that information up front, but then let's say I did put a trampoline park in one of my buildings. And then that's an extreme case because it might be something a lot less than that, but typically, I haven't updated insurance providers whenever I update the tenant. It's just that one upfront event where you give them the information, but you don't update them regularly.
So a couple of things to consider there. Typically, yes, you're only going to be providing your rent rolls once a year, right? So that's part of the risk that they're taking on as your provider is if you're switching out tenants throughout the year, they're not going to know about it. A few exceptions to that, right? Something like a trampoline park, you may be doing significant TI work. And if you're doing TI work that's outside of what would be covered under your property policy, you would need to be notifying your carrier of that. Because you may need to be adding like a builder's risk policy. You may need to be carving that out of your standard package policy. So your broker should be kind of handholding you in that situation because they would need to be guiding you on how the definition of TIs is defined in your policy and what's covered under your policy and what's not. Typically, it's not going to include like any structural TIs. So if you're doing any structural work or anything that's out. And every policy is different in this way. So I wish I could give you like a standard definition of what's going to be covered under TIs and what's not, but a standard definition doesn't exist. So another fun thing about the insurance industry in that way, right? But your broker should know how your policy reads, maybe not off the top of their head, because we have a lot of different policies. So don't call your broker and go, hey, quit pop quiz. How does TI, you know, the definition of TI read under my property policy? Don't put them on the spot like that. But they should be able to pull your policy and read it for you, or have someone on their team do that for them. But they should be able to guide you through. And if you're having a significant thing come in like that, where you may be doing significant TIs or some structural work, moving any load bearing walls or anything like that, you may need to place a separate builder's risk policy to make sure that you're covered properly, or a separate construction GL policy for a short period of time while you're doing those TIs to make sure that you have coverage, because that probably is excluded under your policy. So that's something to be considering. And that is a case where you would be notifying your underwriter midterm and need to make some changes. But the thing that underwriters are going to be looking for there, that's a situation where you really may be looking at getting canceled, or at least that location being carved out of your portfolio policy at renewal, because what we're really seeing in the liability space happening right now, and I actually just did a post about this the other day, funny enough, on the claim side, is these massive verdicts, especially in certain states, right? So this is heavily dependent on where you're located as well. If you're in a highly litigious state, like California, for example, of course, is always the one that gets picked on. Liability claims are just going to be higher by nature because of where we are, right? But a reason that liability rates are higher on different asset classes like multifamily is because liability claims are higher typically. So, and a reason for that is because you're typically dealing with members of the general public more often, right? You're having more people coming and going. So when you start thinking about industrial in that way, in having a tenancy like, okay, we just got a question in the chat. I'll read this later. Let me finish my thought, or else I'll never come back to it. If I lose it, it's not coming back. When you start having something like a trampoline park where you have members of the general public coming and going, now you've changed your risk completely, right? So on the liability side, we've seen in the last couple of years a true kind of bifurcation of claims, where there are businesses that do most of their liability claims come from other businesses, right? But they're really not having these issues with the general public coming onto their property and having those types of claims. And where liability claims have really been blowing up is exactly that, where they're having people coming and going, they're having slip, trips, and falls, they're having issues with the general public, and they have no contractual indemnification provisions or any contractual type of relationship to rely on. And so there's really no safeguards in place to rely on when these claims are filed. And we're seeing these nuclear jury verdicts, right, in these cases. And that's where these liability claims have really gotten out of hand, and carriers have had no options to protect themselves. And in certain jurisdictions, some carriers have even just said, like, no matter what the claim is, we're not going to court on this. We're not going to risk going in front of a jury. We're just going to settle no matter what, no matter how crazy the claim is, no matter what it is, we're just not going to do it, because we've seen how it turns out. And we end up paying these, you know, tens of millions of dollars over nothing, even if it's an insane claim. So we just can't risk it. So to your point, something like a trampoline park where, you know, an incident like that, as rare as it may be, you know, when you have an unfortunate situation like that, where it's one kid, and that's, by the way, every carrier's nightmare. And we write a lot of, you know, construction GL policies, or even a lot of vacant land. And we always think about this because it's our job, right? What's the worst thing that could happen on a piece of vacant land? And that's always the thing that people go to. Kid takes their bike, right? Kid jumps on a excavator, kid, it's always a kid getting hurt, right? That's the worst thing that could possibly happen from a claims perspective, because you're paying it out for the rest of what would have been their life if they get hurt or pass away, right? Actually, from, I hate to say this, but from a claims adjuster's perspective, it's worse if a kid gets paralyzed than if a kid passes away, because now.
Yeah, you're paying ongoing care right. and support for it. Right. So is it good practice then to just talk to the underwriter before you're even considering putting a new tenant in there? Like, I mean, that's
please.
Probably
obvious. Yes, please talk to at least us, right? Talk to your broker. We may say in certain cases, like, don't even bring that, unless you are desperate to fill this space and have no other options, let's not even talk to the underwriter about that, because you're going to be raising a red flag that we don't even need to bring up with them, right? Or we, you know, if there have already been issues and we know that this carrier is already kind of on shaky ground with you, we may not even want to raise another question in their minds right now. Or if we know that this carrier is already considering, again, pulling out of this asset class, maybe their underwriting guidelines are changing and they're considering not even writing industrial real estate in the next couple of years, maybe we don't want to bring up one of those tenants that may be on the borderline for them, right? But yes, absolutely bring it up, because again, it's always better to be playing offense and be able to think about how you want to handle a situation versus, oh, we've already put this tenant in and now we're coming up for renewal and we have no option, right? Because if the carrier says, oh, the tenant's already there, we're canceling your policy, we're absolutely not writing this, and they have, you know, 90 days or 60 days, depending on what jurisdiction you're in, to give you that cancel notice of cancellation, you have no option. You can't force the carrier to write your renewal.
What
So,
are outside of like the ones like that where there's just kids perhaps coming in, which poses an obvious risk in my mind. Like that's
sure.
the telling that story and then hearing your commentary on it makes me think that I would never put a tenant like that into a building. But what are some less obvious ones that you see that have a disproportionate amount of risk?
Yeah, I mean, I think regardless of what it is, there are always things you can do to protect yourself too, right? So those are other things to consider. So it's not to say, because you see trampoline parks, right? So people are doing it and there are people who are doing it better than others. I actually just did a presentation in person recently about industrial real estate, and I had on one slide like two auto body shops. And it was very obvious that they had different housekeeping procedures. They were being run differently. I wish I had the pictures in front of me so I could, you know, show you. But in the presentation that I gave, I asked the audience, like, if you were an underwriter and auto body shops were within your underwriting guidelines, which one of these would you feel comfortable providing insurance for? And when you look at it that way, it's so obvious, right? Because one, you know, was very well maintained, very well taken care of, clean, all the tools were put away properly, you know, it had proper ventilation that you could see, and the other one was just kind of in disarray, right? And so that's important too, is not just what type of tenant it is it, but how is the tenant kind of operating their business on day to day. And that's another thing that's really changed, is carriers used to always put in their quotes like, we have the right to inspect within 90 days, but we would rarely see carriers actually go out and inspect. Now they do. Like, they're actually putting boots on the ground and having people go look at your property, or they're really pulling up this real-time satellite imaging and looking all around it. If they're not going in, they're at least looking all around it to see if there's any, you know, little indicator that something might be off. And if they're seeing any debris around the side of the property or anything that looks like you may have some poor housekeeping going on, then they're sending someone out to go look inside. So they're kind of playing detective a little bit. And they want to, you know, they want to know that things are clean and well maintained, which is fair, you know, and they're looking for things like, if you have any type of, you know, compressed gas cylinders, are those, you know, locked and put away the way that they should be? Are they being kept outside instead of in the building? You know, they don't want to deal with an explosion, nor should they, right? I mean, they want to be insuring risks that are not likely to be a massive claim, and that's something that is reasonable, right? I mean, people should have good housekeeping procedures. That's not unreasonable from an underwriting perspective. So those are all important things, and then contractual risk mitigation as well. You know, and underwriters won't always get into this. Some underwriters will and some won't, but it's something that you should be looking at with your broker, right? From an owner's perspective, how much risk can you push back on the tenant contractually? How much can you make them responsible for? So something like that situation where the child was injured at the trampoline park, you know, how much of that is going to be pushed back on the tenant's insurance versus the owner's insurance? And really, I mean, the tenant's insurance should be primary for a loss like that. So how much insurance was the tenant being required to carry? And were they required to, you know, name the owner as AI, provide a waiver of subrogation, and all of those types of things? It's important.
What can a landlord or a broker even do to figure this out in advance, because if it gets to the underwriting stage and it's the much more scrutiny that's done at that level, how can a landlord even know in advance that the tenant is complying with everything that they should be doing, whether it's work logs or procedures? Is that something that someone can do in advance, or is it just one of those things that until it gets to underwriting, you're not going to know?
Sure. I mean, really, it's all going to come back to your lease, right? So when you're negotiating with this tenant, what are you negotiating with them, right? And a lot of it is contractual risk transfer. So are you requiring them, if they're storing goods in a warehouse, do they have a responsibility for approved goods? And if they're storing anything that's not an approved good, what is the ramification of that? Do they have stacking heights in the lease? What safety measures are required? All of those things are important, because again, if you have contractual risk transfer in your lease, then even if the tenant's not doing the things that they're supposed to be doing, your insurance is not going to be on the hook. You're going to indemnify that. They're going to indemnify you, and it's going to go back to them, and their insurance is going to be primary, and they're going to be the ones who are ultimately responsible for all the things that they're not doing that they're supposed to be doing. Right? Because you can't be the world's police force. You can't go around making sure that they're doing the things that they're supposed to be doing every day, but you can contractually obligate them to do those things. And then if they're not, it's on them.
So how often are you seeing a lease that actually will go into that type of detail, saying that racking can only be a certain height and really itemizing all of that risk transfer?
We see it. We see it pretty often. I mean, it depends, you know, it's one of those things. The larger and the more sophisticated the landlord, the more likely it is that you're going to see those things, right? Mm-hmm. If they have a dedicated risk management team or a dedicated legal team, you're going to see those things almost certainly. So it really depends on who you're dealing with, what you're dealing with. If it's a one-off owner, you know, mom and pop kind of local deal, very unlikely, right? So it just kind of depends. You see the gamut of leases. We see some leases that have been there for 10 years that have never been updated, that don't have a whole heck of a lot at all. They're pretty anemic. So you see all kinds of things.
I'd echo that comment as well, as the big, large, sophisticated owners have full risk management teams. They'll probably have a risk officer that's dedicated to just identifying every single tenancy. But if you go to the other side, that one owner that owns a 10,000 square foot building, it's probably not even on his radar to think about that as a potential risk. So it really is eye-opening, not for the large institutional owners, but everybody who's not getting to that same level of the risks that are in there. That's really interesting. The one that I actually dealt with a couple of years ago was a company that had chemicals, and they had material data handling sheets on everything that they stored. And it was a clean, established operation. And this was a satellite warehouse for them. And they had a hell of a time trying to get insurance on it. They just, like, we had to go through numerous different insurance providers to finally find one that had it, even though they had all that procedure in place. Are you finding that, is it case by case basis that some uses will just be really difficult to insure?
Yeah, we've had, I mean, it's tough too, if you have, I mean, we've had the one that everybody jokes about, right, is like a fireworks tenant. Like, nobody wants that, right? We've had like liquor distributors. I don't know why and I still to this day don't understand why underwriters can't wrap their head around liquor distributors, because you really don't have a liquor liability exposure with that, because nobody's serving alcohol. But for some reason, carrier underwriters are no people, okay, by definition. I always say, like, lawyers and underwriters, the easiest thing for them to say is no, right? That's the safest answer always. So then our job is kind of to get them to yes somehow, right? And so they see anything with liquor in it and it's no. And I'm like, but this is a distribution facility. They're distributing alcohol. They're not selling alcohol. Nobody's opening a bottle. They're just distributing liquor. But they're like, but liquor's outside of the underwriting guidelines. So that was one that was, it was a nightmare trying to get coverage for it. which is crazy because the actual exposure there, if you, I'm like, can you come out to this with me and look at what they're doing? Like, it, the struggle that we went through trying to find someone who would write that exposure was absolutely insane for what the exposure was versus the risk. But certain things like that, yeah, I mean, anything that has any type of like corrosive chemical, as you mentioned, anything that could potentially explode, anything, you know, I mean, anything that you go through that list of, you know, there's a list of questions that's like, is, you know, is it flammable? Is it this? Is it that? And if any of those yes, no questions are marked yes, that's a big red flag. And the underwriters are going to ask a lot more questions and you're going to have issues. And then, you know, you have your admitted carriers and your non-admitted carriers, right? So if you have any of those issues, a lot of the admitted carriers right away, you know, your Hartford, your Travelers, your Allianz, your all of those, you know, kind of in the box standard markets are going to be out of wanting to write that risk pretty quickly, right? Same with your trampoline parks and things like that. Now, if you have a really large portfolio and this is a small portion of it, you can usually get them to do it, right? But if you have one location and your trampoline park is, or if you have two locations and your trampoline park is 40% of your portfolio, you're much less likely to be able to get an underwriter to agree to write that risk for you. So there's all different kinds of things that go into the equation.
Yeah, well said. So you're active on Twitter, and we'll include your Twitter handle. I'd encourage people to connect with you on there. Any other way that people can get in touch with you if they want to reach out?
I think Twitter's good, or LinkedIn is good, or I don't know if you want to drop my email. If anybody wants to email me, they're more than welcome to do that too. Happy to answer any questions.
We'll put that in the show notes as well. Skylar, thanks so much for taking the time to
thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Yeah, it was awesome. I always come away from these learning something new, and that this one's no different. So thank you very much for taking the time to jump on with us.
Of course. All right. Thanks. Bye, guys.
Thanks, Skylar. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Chat with you soon.